Good morning. This is Hugh LaFolla, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Karen Lasser, lecturer at Harvard Medical School, and we're going to be discussing Atul Gawande's complications. Karen, glad to have you on the show.
Oh, yeah, it's great to be here today.
For the benefit of the listeners who perhaps didn't hear the interview with Atul Gawande, perhaps you could give your take on what you see as the principal themes of this book.
Sure. Yeah, there's a few major themes here, only some of which I'm going to touch on today in the interview. I think the main theme is that Dr. Gawande looks at how medicine is an imperfect science, how doctors often have no medical explanation for what is happening, and that doctors are human and fallible. Another major theme of his book is the risks of new treatments to patients and how to avoid errors. He talks about the need for routinization and repetition. Those are some of the main themes I had wanted to comment on today. There are also a couple other themes I thought were interesting that he touches on, how we should train our residents, the new doctors, and that's particularly relevant today because we're in the month of July, which is when the new residents are on service. And finally, the last theme I thought was interesting was the question of decision making. How much should doctors guide patients versus give all the information to patients and let them make decisions?
Okay, that's a very helpful introduction. Mm-hmm. I want to go back and look at each of those themes in more detail. The first one, and it seems to me that you're right, that's the sort of overarching theme, if you will, of the book, is that medicine itself is, in some sense, an uncertain science, and also that doctors are human and fallible. Mm-hmm. And these seem to be deeply related, but also slightly different points. One has to do with the nature of the science itself. Mm-hmm. One has to do with the nature of the people who are practicing physicians. I wonder if you could pick out a few points that you think are especially important that illustrate this this uncertainty and this fallibility.
Well, I was going to start by just talking about a few examples in my own practice. I'm an internist and a primary care doctor, and the type of uncertainty that I come across every day. One of the most common things that I see is symptoms that patients have that cannot be explained medically. Patients with abdominal pain or chest pain, where we do a bunch of tests, they all come out normal, but the patient is still sitting in front of you with the pain, and you can't explain it to them, and it's challenging. And I think one of the ways I've learned to approach this is that it's really okay for doctors to say, "I don't know." Dr. Gawande's book, he actually talks about a vignette of a patient who has intractable nausea and vomiting. And he says that the patient said that the doctors she liked the best were the few who admitted they didn't know how to explain to her what her nausea was caused by or what to do about it. So just that, you know, there's a lot of things that we can't explain, and that it's really okay for doctors to say, "I don't know," and I think patients might like to hear that.
Okay, when that happens, I mean, it seems to me there may be two different issues here.
Yeah.
One is doctors being upfront about the fact that they may not know the answer to some particular problem. They either don't know what's causing it, or they don't know what to do about it. And those are, again, related but slightly different issues.
Yep.
Once a doctor says, "I don't know," though, what is the appropriate way for the doctor to proceed at that point?
I think the appropriate way to proceed is to say, "I don't know, but I'm here with you, and I know that you're suffering, and I want to make you feel better." So to say, even though we don't know what's causing this, I believe you that you're experiencing this pain, and I'm here with you, even if the scientific knowledge isn't.
Is it also incumbent upon the physician, perhaps, to make a referral, or do they say, look, it's not just that I don't know, that nobody knows, or it's unlikely that anyone knows?
Yeah, at this point, a lot of times the referral has been made. You have the patient, say, with the abdominal pain, who's been sent to the gastroenterologist specialist, who's had the endoscopy and the colonoscopy and the x-rays of their stomach, and they've actually been to all the specialists, and they can't find anything, and they send the patient back to you, the primary care doctor, who really, you know, still has to address the patient and their symptoms that the specialist couldn't explain what was causing the symptom.
You know, you did accurately mention the story in the book, the example in the book, but I wonder how many patients would be so understanding. I mean, I certainly get the sense sometimes that when people go to a physician, they go because they want an answer.
Yeah.
And when they don't get it there, they think that the doctor isn't doing her or his job.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know of any empirical data that says that, you know, what percentage of patients are satisfied versus not satisfied by hearing the I don't know from their doctor. So I think it's a good question, and I agree that I think a lot of patients do want to know the answer. But ultimately, when the answer can't be found, I would think that patients would be more understanding of hearing their doctor saying that instead of kind of, you know, putting forth explanations that really aren't true, or, you know, always going on this endless search for the explanation.
Well, certainly it seems that the patient would be happier hearing up front, I don't know, than hearing, yes, I do know, mm-hmm. and then finding repeatedly that, you know, when the doctor tries to intervene in the way that they think they know, it doesn't work.
Yeah. And one thing to mention is I think in our training, that's the last thing we're taught we should tell a patient is, I don't know. I think there's a lot of posturing that goes on in medicine and always needing to appear confident and that you know the answer and you know everything. So it's not something that's really sanctioned by the medical profession. But I will say that when I was a resident in training, one of the attendings who was most respected in our hospital was someone who would be very aware of, you know, when he didn't know something and say, you know, let's all go look it up in a book and find out, or let's do a literature search, or, you know, I think it was helpful.
I'm wondering, too, mm-hmm. how all this, I mean, if it's true that doctors are told, don't be upfront, don't admit that you don't know, mm-hmm. and patients have this mistaken perception about what doctors can do. Mm-hmm. You know, I go to the doctor to get cured. I don't go to the doctor to be told, I mm-hmm. don't know.
Yeah.
That somehow this distorts the physician-patient relationships in unacceptable ways.
Well, I guess, you know, my sense is these I don't know situations are probably in the minority. In most cases, we do know what's going on. You know, a patient comes in with a sore throat and a runny nose, we can say that's probably a viral infection. So I think I was touching on a theme that Dr. Gawande brought up in a few of his patients. But I think, you know, most of the time, or a good deal of the time, we do know. But I think it's in those instances where we don't know that it's incumbent upon us to say that.
Well, I know one of the things that you've talked about is that the fact that medical science is uncertain, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that even with our best efforts, even with very careful physicians, mm-hmm. Sometimes we don't know, or sometimes we think we know when in mm-hmm. fact we don't know, and that in your view seems to mean that physicians ought to be more cautious than perhaps sometimes they are.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could elaborate on that view a bit.
Yeah, I was again going to kind of pull an example from my training. I think when you're a new doctor in the hospital, you know, one of the first powers you have is the power to write a prescription. And I remember when I was in residency, there were really two extremes of how doctors would prescribe new drugs. I remember there was a younger doctor who, as soon as a new drug came out, he would be the first one prescribing it and prescribing it to all his patients, and really felt that he was doing his patients justice, or bringing them the most cutting-edge care because he was the first one out there prescribing that drug. Whereas there was another doctor who was a little older, who always cautioned us. He would say, you know, this new drug just came out, but you should probably wait a few years to see, you know, maybe not all the side effects have been discovered, or we don't really know how this drug is going to work. So I always tended to lean towards the doctor who was more cautious or a little more modest. And, you know, later in the show, I may discuss some of my research that has to do with that exact question, how long we should wait before using new drugs. But it's a difficult question.
That really is a point I wanted to move to next. Yeah. I did want to ask sort of one intervening question that occurred to me. I mean, you've talked about the fact that medical science is uncertain and that physicians are fallible, that they both may not understand the information that's there, or they may not be able to execute it to use it in the way they ought to.
Yeah.
But I realize one thing that he doesn't talk about in his book that may be connected to this, and I think it does lead into your research, is that maybe pharmaceutical companies also ought to be more cautious in the claims that they make.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. A lot of the claims that they make are actually untrue. There have been a few studies of this that have shown that about 10% of the statements that pharmaceutical representatives make at conferences where doctors in training are present are simply false, and they're always biased in favor of their drug. So I think the pharmaceutical industry isn't the best source of information for doctors to use about which new drugs to prescribe.
Let's move into to talk about those drugs. I'd like to pause just for a moment for the benefit of anyone who's tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Karen Lasser, lecturer at Harvard Medical School, and we're discussing Atul Gawande's complications. You've recently finished a study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that talks about just this problem of, well, at least mistaken claims made on behalf of drugs, especially about the safety of drugs. There may also be another question about the efficaciousness of drugs. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that study and what you found there.
I'll briefly summarize the results of what we found. We looked at all drugs that were approved between 1975 and 2000 and kind of followed their course. And what we found was that 20% of all new drugs ultimately had a very serious side effect that was life-threatening, that necessitated a strong black box warning in the physician's desk reference, or the drug needed to be withdrawn from the market. So that was one in five drugs had a serious problem, and that only half of these problems were discovered within 7 years of the drug's introduction.
Okay, so there are two different points there.
Yeah.
And so by serious side effect, you mean that they are life-threatening?
Yeah, the most common problems that were found were cardiovascular problems, such as a drug causing an irregular heart rhythm that could be fatal, liver toxicity, including fatal liver failure, toxicity to the bone marrow causing life-threatening anemia, or risks in pregnancy, risks to the fetus. Those were the types of most common problems that arose that weren't known when the drug was first approved.
Okay, and you said there one in five fell into this category of either of having some sort of serious side effects and or were even withdrawn. And
exactly.
I'm assuming the difference between those is in the case of those who were withdrawn, either the side effects were especially probable or else the benefits of the drug were not all that substantial, whereas in the other cases, maybe there were serious side effects, but also the benefits were pretty important.
Exactly.
Roughly, do you know how to divide those? Which ones, what percentage were actually withdrawn?
About 16 drugs were withdrawn over the study period. 45 drugs acquired one or more new warnings, and 16 were withdrawn.
Okay.
And a few of those withdrawn drugs first had the black box warning and then were subsequently withdrawn.
Okay. And the thing that's especially interesting is that the significance of these dangers, you said, was not a parent until, was it 7 years, did you say, after?
Yeah, really, only half of the changes were discovered within 7 years of the drug's introduction. So we followed the drugs out for 25 years, and only half of the problems were detected within 7 years. And that the reason that number seven is interesting is it gets back to that question, you know, how long should you wait until you prescribe a new drug that isn't a breakthrough drug? And, you know, I think doctors have been using all sorts of numbers, wait 1 year, wait 2 years, wait 5 years. And what our study found was even if you waited 7 years, you would only avoid half of the problems.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, there's an interesting question there, too. I mean, one is you're talking about how long should the physician wait before they start prescribing the drug? But there's another question, too, is how long should a patient, should it be before a patient's willing to take the drug?
Yeah,
or at least to put up some sort of fuss if the physician recommends the drug.
Yeah, because it's really the patient who is at risk, who will suffer the harm. You know, if a doctor prescribes a drug and there's a problem, it's really the patient who suffers. You know, the doctor feels bad, but I think that's an important point to make, is that patients need to be aware of this as well.
You know, it's funny, too. There's sort of an assumption that newer is better. And, I mean, I remember some years ago I worked on the Human Subjects Committee at the local Veterans Administration, and, and the physicians who were doing drug studies would come in, and it was really a very common line that they would give, which was, well, if my wife had X disease, this is the drug I would give her. It's brand new and it's great.
Yeah.
Now, I confess, sometimes I wondered what they thought about their wives when they said that. But, But it does suggest there's this assumption that if it's new, it's better.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And when I look at the list of the drugs that were withdrawn, a number of them were new, but they really weren't better. They didn't really represent a breakthrough. An example of a drug like that would be a drug called Duract, which was what's called a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory that's really in the same family of a drug like Motrin or Advil or ibuprofen. And to imagine that you take this new drug thinking it's better and you die of liver failure from it. So there are quite a few drugs on the list that really weren't breakthroughs at all.
In fact, I don't remember you actually addressing this in your study, so I may just be asking you something that you can't really answer. But I do think that is the separate question.